The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today on the show, we're taking a sobering look into addiction and the overdose epidemic, a topic that many Granite Staters know all too well. New Hampshire currently ranks third in overdose deaths per capita. That's the highest rate among New England states, and we're last in the region for funding prevention or treatment options. The seeds for the state's high death rate may have been sown years ago. For decades, New Hampshire has ranked near the bottom or dead last in state spending for treatment. In 1997, for example, the total amount of money the state spent on substance misuse services of any kind was $25,000.
We can and we have to do a better job at intervening early in people's progression. You know, addiction is a disease of early onset. My name is Michael Botticelli. I'm the executive director of the Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine at Boston Medical Center.
Botticelli worked as the nation's drug czar during the last years of the Obama administration. Now, that was after spending 18 years at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. He's been called one of the nation's leading addiction experts and has been a key influence in reshaping the narrative around addiction. A lot of his work in public has been to pivot talk of addiction away from morality and instead understand it as a disease deserving the same care as other major health issues. Botticelli says one way to address that stigmatization is to listen to the stories of people with addiction.
They bring a unique voice and a unique perspective that few other people, I think, can really understand the way that someone who's been through addiction and has been on their journey of recovery can bring to the discussion. But the other piece that I think is really important is that, you know, we know the way that we view people with histories of substance use disorders dramatically impacts public policy. So, you know, if we think people are bad people, if we think they're morally flawed, it means that they should be punished.
Botticelli is not coming to this conversation as some out-of-touch policymaker, but rather as someone who has struggled with addiction in his own life. He's talked openly about his struggle with alcoholism and his past drug use, and he knows that the public conversation can change over time. As a gay man, he's seen it. And while he says homosexuality is still stigmatized, it's nothing like it was 30 years ago.
I think when you look at LGBT issues, we don't think about GLBT folks in the same way. We have significant amount of laws now that protect against discrimination and give LGBT folks the same rights. I think about kind of media portrayals too, right? And how, you know, it wasn't that long ago that the only portrayals that you saw on TV were often very negative. And now that's not the case. And so, you know, it really shows for me what we can do and how far we still need to go to do a better job at changing the perception, changing the language, change how people with addiction are portrayed.
On today's show, Word of Mouth is doing just that. Producer Jimmy Gutierrez takes the lead with one local man's story that asks us to think about the roots of addiction, access to treatment, and whether public policy treats addiction as a disease or a crime.
Before I start, just real quick, we'll start from over here. If you just give me your first name, just real quick.
This is Jeff Marshall.
Your first name?
But every first Thursday of the month, in a sterile, windowless room in Concord, he sits in front of a group of 20 or so and goes by another name.
All right, my name is inmate 83236. That's my name. Why is it my name? Because that's what the prison gave me.
Jeff's an ex-convict, and he's sharing his story for a program called Operation Impact. Think of a mashup between Scared Straight and First-Hand Testimony. Operation Impact is an alternative to the court systems, giving participants the option to avoid prosecution.
I believe all people can make change when given the opportunity. And I've been in the field for 30 years.
Ginny Arenella is the program coordinator here at the Merrimack County Diversion Program, and she oversees Operation Impact.
Most of the clientele we service are people who are violation, misdemeanors, or felonies. Primarily, there's a lot of substance misuse clients in the system.
That includes Jeff Marshall. And while he served his sentence, Jeff's story gets to a bigger question in this moment. How do we treat crimes involving people with addiction? Do we treat them, or do we prosecute them? And what can we learn from Jeff Marshall's story?
Due to a number of things, in my childhood, I wasn't involved with girls for the most part.
Jeff grew up in the small New Hampshire town of Kingston. He was popular in high school, fitting in with most crowds. As far as interest went, baseball was life. His favorite player, Carl Yastrzemski.
I don't know, for whatever reason, I connected with him, which is weird because he was a left fielder, and I've been a shortstop since 3 years old, so.
During his youth, he stayed clear of drugs and alcohol, big league dreams filling his head. But after high school in the early 80s, he fell in with a crowd that regularly drank and smoked weed.
Who I was with, and again, not wanting to, I guess, be looked upon as, you know, somebody that they didn't want to hang out with, whatever. I went along, and it was definitely a progression.
He says he took to everything. Soon he was binge drinking and turning to harder drugs like hallucinogens. Then came opioids.
That's the scary part of addiction. Most of the time, most people don't know what's happening until it's too late.
From the 90s to the mid-2000s, Jeff got married, divorced, and had a child. Through it all, the addiction never left. Then in 2006, living at his mom's house and out of work, things started to get out of control.
The last thing as an addict that you want is to get dope sick. That is not an option. If there is any other option, you take any other option.
Being dope sick or going through withdrawals can come with insomnia, nausea, and diarrhea, just to name a couple of symptoms. Jeff, on the verge of being sick, called his ex-wife who lived in Connecticut for help.
She told me on the phone that she tried calling some people and nobody had anything to help me. And all she had was a half of a Vicodin. She said, "That's all I got." And she said, "You know, you're not going to want to come down 3 hours for that." And I said, "I'm on my way."
Jeff drove 6 hours in total. It barely got him through the night. Back at his mom's house, things were disappearing more and more. Possessions, money, pain meds.
Well, I need money, so how do I get money? Well, you take things, you pawn them, you steal money, you do all these things that are horrifying to survive.
To keep up with the mounting bills, in part because of supporting her son, Jeff's mom had to sell the family's home in 2007. Jeff, now 43 years old, ended up at Crossroads, a shelter in Portsmouth. And that's where everything would change.
A bunch of people, every once in a while from the shelter that I was staying at, would rent a motel room or a hotel room just to get away from the shelter environment, basically.
On an October night in 2007, a group of people rented two rooms at the Comfort Inn in Portsmouth. The group included three men and three women. Many, like Jeff, were residents at Crossroads. The event was a Red Sox playoff game, a good excuse to party. In one room, people watched the game, drank beer, and hung out into the early morning. The other room was saved for hard drug use. At some point in the night, a man named Anthony Fosher, who Jeff had known for about a month from the shelter, gave him $500 asking if he could pick up cocaine. Jeff couldn't get any, but he could pick up heroin. That night, Fosher and another woman would snort heroin in one room, while Jeff was in the other. Another person in the group that night was Jeff's girlfriend. She lived at the shelter too. She was also in Fosher's room, helping to cut up the heroin. She kept an eye on Fosher throughout the night. In the morning, she noticed his breathing had slowed. she and another woman began to worry about his condition. Then a few hours later, around noon, they called 911. Fosher was unresponsive.
Oh, I'm panicking at this point. You know, definitely panicking, afraid for my own skin, and definitely afraid for what's going to happen to me.
Jeff left the hotel before police and paramedics arrived. He took with him cash Fosher had stolen a few nights before. At the hospital, 36-year-old Anthony Fosher was pronounced dead.
My name is Joseph Prieto. I'm a lawyer in Manchester, and I specialize in criminal defense.
In 2009, Prieto was working for the Public Defender's Office in Stratham. That's when he started working on Jeff's case. Jeff was charged with two felonies, receiving stolen property and sales of a narcotic. The latter was elevated to a pre-existing statute called death resulting. It was a charge that was coming back in fad with the courts to increase jail time in overdose death cases.
And so they sort of, when this whole drug epidemic started happening, they're saying, what tools do we have? And this is one of them.
In brief, the law says that anyone who manufactures, sells, or dispenses a Schedule 1 or 2 drug is on the hook for any death occurring from the use of that substance. And while that reads extremely broad, the law doesn't require intent or willing participation on the victim's end. In New Hampshire, home to some of the toughest drug laws in the country, a low-level narcotic sale could land someone a bid of up to 7 years. In contrast, death resulting came with the possibility of a life sentence. Prieto argued that Jeff had nothing to do with the drugs after the drop-off.
When they're in that other room, Jeff's not there. And the other girls, they take the drugs out. They cut up the drugs. They make lines out of the drugs, and they're doing the drugs. Jeff's not even there.
He made another point, too. Anthony Fosher had been drinking.
But when you combine alcohol with these drugs, or with this drug, heroin, death results. In a crazy alarming rate, the percentage goes through the roof when you have those two factors combined.
At trial, an expert witness from Dartmouth-Hitchcock cited a study that found, alcohol aside, the level of heroin in Fosher's system put a survival rate over 99%. The toxicologist from the lab examining Fosher's blood and urine concluded heroin alone was not the cause of death. The question became, would a jury find Jeff Marshall solely responsible for the death of Anthony Fosher? After 3 days of testimony, the verdict was in. Guilty on all charges. No one else there that night would face felony charges or jail time.
After you get convicted, or if you're convicted, usually what happens is the court will order what's called a PSI.
A pre-sentence investigation. An officer from the Department of Corrections meets with the defendant and the victims to put together a summary of the case.
And they'll make a recommendation as to what they think would be a fair sentence.
The recommendation isn't binding, but it is from a state agency.
The recommendation was time served. The recommendation was release him. He spent a year in jail, and that 12 months at the House of Corrections is a reasonable, fair sentence.
But the judge, Honorable Tina Nadeau, thought otherwise. Jeff, who is now 45 with no past criminal record, still remembers what she said to him at sentencing.
I've looked at the statute very carefully and I've read everything very clearly, and it's very clear that I have to send a strong message and I have to send a severe punishment to you. If this stops one person from dying, then it's worth me giving you a 10 to life.
Judge Nadeau chose not to comment for this story.
10 to life means that you are sentenced to a life sentence at the New Hampshire State Prison.
At a minimum, the next 10 years of Jeff Marshall's life would be spent locked up with the possibility of parole to follow. Even after his release and for the rest of his life, the state would have the right to search him, his home, confine him to certain areas, and more.
You give up a lot of your rights because technically you're still an inmate. You have not finished your sentence.
The year before Jeff's trial, Judge Nadeau sentenced another man with a much different story to the exact same sentence, the equivalent of second-degree murder. At the time, Rockingham County Attorney Jim Reams called it a history-setting case for the state and good history. What we know now is that 2009 was the dawn of the state's overdose epidemic. Just 2 years later, the number of overdose deaths increased by 20%. A number that is more than double the last 3 years. The truth is that while some state courts and prosecutors have viewed lengthy jail sentences as an answer to overdose death cases, the majority of these cases are not spent prosecuting drug dealers and kingpins, but people with active substance use disorders.
When you talk about this war on drugs, it's like that is like a massive amount of resources. Massive amount of resources for an addict.
While Jeff spent 2 years awaiting trial and sentencing in the House of Corrections, he was still very much an addict. On intake to the state prison, he asked about treatment options. He was told those services would be available when he was within 2 years of his minimum. He had 6 years to wait.
Everybody worries and complains about a problem, but in this particular situation, when you arrest people and you put them in prison, you're not fixing the problem. You're not trying to fix that problem, so the problem just continues.
While substance treatment was unavailable, there was mental health counseling. He began taking self-help classes, too, determined to understand this addiction. How did it start, and how could he stop it? The combination of counseling, self-help, and head-on confrontation of his addiction led to a revelation.
Things that I couldn't address, my abuse when I was little, and that's, again, when it became clear that, okay, I have to start talking about this stuff.
He says at first that was impossible. In some counseling sessions, there were just places he couldn't go. One counselor called him his most difficult patient ever. Then one day, he was ready to talk.
What happens when you get molested or raped or assaulted? The weirdest thing happens to the victim. The victim feels like it was their fault.
Jeff says when he was 11 years old, he was molested by a family member, and no one in the family knew. During a visitation with his mom, older brother Jay, and sister-in-law, he decided to tell them. When he did, he remembers his older brother storming off from the table, calling him a liar.
And the messed up thing was, I understood why he did that, because I had lied to them for so long about so many things. Everything, almost everything I said was a lie. It was, you know... The boy who cried wolf, there it is.
2/3 of people with addiction have experienced at least one extremely traumatic childhood experience. The more severe the trauma, the greater the risk of addiction.
I mean, severe childhood trauma in general, you're looking at pretty much everybody in prison.
Trauma makes itself known in lots of different ways. Addiction, a prison sentence, an overdose death. And as we're beginning to understand, it can even be passed down genetically. Jeff worried about his son, Zach, who was 11 years old at his sentencing. Jeff was getting word that Zach had started using drugs. Another way trauma makes itself known is in damaged relationships. While Zach would still come to visit, Jeff's youngest brother, who asked not to be named, cut off all contact.
That's his right and his choice. I feel horrible that that's where we're at now. You know, hopefully we can someday patch that up. But that relationship is gone as of right now.
One relationship that has endured is with his mom, Pauline. On June 26, 2017, a little under 10 years since his arrest, Jeff Marshall was free to start a new life. And Pauline, the same woman who had been manipulated, lied to, and stolen from, was there waiting for him.
Hi.
Not nice out.
Oops, careful.
Postponing Christmas for the Marshalls is nothing new. What is for Pauline to receive gifts from her middle son. Jeff hands over 2 gift wrap boxes and Christmas tree wrapping paper.
You made me cry.
Tony made me cry all the time. In a good way, by the way.
Pauline remembers Jeff's first day out. There was no training manual or class on how to readjust. 20-plus years an addict, 10 as a prisoner.
It had to happen. I mean, first time out after, you know, so many years, yeah, it's a scary world. And you're always looking over your shoulder while you're in prison. So that doesn't go away because you go to Walmart.
Panic attacks can be normal for people readjusting to society like service members and ex-convicts. And when Pauline took Jeff to Walmart for essentials that first day, it was too much. Too many choices, too much movement. Impossible to check blind spots.
And you could see it. You could see it coming. The looking around and the fear, I think. You could see the fear in him. And by the time he got to the car, everything just let go. Which was okay, because that was a good thing.
Since his release, Jeff has had at least 5 panic attacks, but things are getting better, and nothing like that first day. In his cramped 2-room apartment, where drapes up for doors, he tells Pauline about how difficult it was to even find this place. He says it was one of the few apartments that didn't immediately hang up on him when he asked if they rent to felons. Jeff says it's not the housing or lack of a living wage job that cuts deep, though. That space is safe for family. Hearing about his son struggling with drugs, or being so close but so far from his younger brother.
Everything takes time, and it's only been a few months, okay?
Well, he hasn't spoken to me in 10 years, so...
I understand that. And I try to get where he is, and I can't do it.
What do you think that is in him?
It's me. He's upset because of what he did to me, and I've forgiven him. It wasn't him. It was the sickness. It was the illness that did that, and I can't seem to make him understand that. But someday, maybe. I hope. I always hope.
Give yourselves a chance. Give your families a chance. You guys are worth that, I'm telling you. Because you don't want this. You don't want any part of this.
Back at Operation Impact, most of the faces have leaned into Jeff's story. After the talk, some participants come up for handshakes. A woman approaches for a hug. Jeff returns the favor cautiously. She wishes him good luck. He tells her the same. Ginny Arenella, who supervises the program, says the people in this room are lucky to hear Jeff's story because it's relatable.
Many of our clients have done the same behaviors, you know, picking up something for someone else or handing something to someone else. And even as small as that may seem, I mean, it wasn't as if he went out and, you know, robbed a bank or did something on the more of an intentional level, like most would think that commit crimes. This was something that he was doing a favor for another user.
Arenella says the program hasn't received any major funding increases in over a decade. A part of that is the push and pull of how society views addiction, which dictates where funds are allocated. She knows the general public can have a lot of trouble getting past an arrest record.
Once they hear that a person has been arrested, there's an automatic stigma that goes with that. And we have to explain to the client or to the person in general, people in general, that just because it has that with it doesn't define the person and who they are.
For people like Jeff Marshall, acceptance is still a work in progress. While landlords, employers, and family may judge him for his past, he's working hard to create a future. But he can't help but wonder what his life would look like if he would have had someone to talk to after being molested, and if he would have ever had addiction issues. He wonders if Anthony Foscher would still be alive if there had been accessible drug treatment when he started to get sick. He wonders how different his son's life might look, or if he would still be able to pick up a phone and call his youngest brother. What he does know is that without a state pardon, he'll stay on parole for the rest of his life, always connected to his past.
You know, you go around and you ask for everyone's name, right? And it's kind of like to get people into it.
Yep.
You know, can you tell me why you do that?
Because it's very important that they lose their name. It's for them to understand that they lose their name, they lose their identity, and they are given a new identity, and it's not a name, it is a number. You are now a number, you are nothing more.
Do you feel like you got your name back?
No. Not yet.
Coming up, a listener lucky enough not to be personally affected by the opioid crisis asks how to help those who are. The answer could be to let down your Yankee guard and get a little more personal. We'll hear about how building social capital could save lives when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 100,000 Americans have died of opioid overdoses in the past 3 years. In New Hampshire, that number is more than 1,200, while 2017 state numbers project a small decrease in overdose deaths. The problem is still very front and center for a large number of Granite State families, but not for all. Wendy from Nashua asked our Only in New Hampshire series, what can Granite Staters who are lucky enough to be untouched by the opioid crisis do to help those who are? Well, there are a number of threads to pull when it comes to opioid addiction, treatment, and policy. Maya Sulovitz is a neuroscience journalist specializing in addiction who wrote about an unlikely key to understanding the overdose epidemic and an idea that is starting to get traction, social capital. Maya, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So refresh us. What exactly is social capital?
Social capital is the bond or web of connections that people have to each other. It's the social bonds that sustain a community. And this sounds like something that is kind of airy-fairy that you could not measure, but it's measured in questions like, do you think people can be trusted or do you think you can't be too careful? It's also measured in things like civic participation, like voting, and in participation in voluntary and other local social organizations.
And some of those indicators you mentioned have been in sharp decline for a while. So what's the connection here between overdose deaths and social capital?
Well, basically, the less social capital you have, the higher your overdose death rate will be.
And is that a community-based thing, a location-based thing?
Yeah, it seems to be pretty much location-based, and it has to do with several different things. For one, opioids are in the brain. One of the functions that they have is to socially connect us to each other.
Mm-hmm.
When a mom interacts with her baby, the oxytocin system, not to be confused with OxyContin, but the oxytocin system wires her brain's natural opioids to be released when she's in the presence of the baby, so she feels good around her baby. And when our social bonds fray, which is what has been happening lately in a lot of places, the attraction of opioid drugs becomes greater.
It's interesting because some of the causes of the opioid crisis, a lot of things pointed to, easy and cheap access to drugs, prolific prescriptions of pain medications, economic factors, lack of opportunity. But social capital, how does that play into this?
Well, that is kind of involved in many of those different things. For example, the prescribing rates for opioids in communities with really low social capital are higher. Now, we don't know if that's because people in those communities are going to the doctor and faking pain, or if they are actually having pain and having more pain because of the economic despair. You know, that's very hard to sort out, but it's definitely the case that people are at higher risk of addiction when they lose a job, when they lose social status, when they don't have a source of meaning, purpose, and connection. So all of these factors are kind of deeply interrelated, and it becomes very difficult to say, well, did A cause B or whatever. But what is clear is that people's connection to each other is a really important way to reduce the risk of addiction in the first place, to help people who have addiction heal from it, and to also reduce the risk of overdose death.
Well, how about as to Wendy's question, what can a Granite Stater do to help people affected by the crisis? So what does social capital look like when it comes to addiction?
Sure. Well, I mean, one of the obvious things is that a lot of people with addiction go to support groups and help each other by creating new social bonds. But if you are somebody who is not directly affected, and that is rare, but if you are such a person and you want to help, the main thing that you can do is be kind, be connected and be participatory and work on activities that will increase community-level trust. And that, again, can sound kind of disconnected, but the thing about addiction is that it is characterized by isolation and shame and stigma.
Hmm.
And the way we've dealt with this as a society is to say, you people are criminals. We're going to lock you up. You don't have a medical condition. We don't care about you. We're just going to punish you and hope that that will stop you from doing stuff we don't want you to do. And that's a really terrible way to deal with addiction, which, by the way, is defined by compulsive behavior that continues despite negative consequences.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and addicts are known for being loyal to their drug more than to their family. You know, there's an inability to connect that is a hallmark of addiction. So how do you get over that?
Well, I mean, what's interesting about that is that partially that's a myth. It's certainly the case that people do kind of fall in love with a drug and prioritize that over everything else. But that does not mean that people with addiction are unreachable. The way people with addiction become unreachable, however, is if they think you're judging them and you won't have anything to do with them unless they immediately change their behavior. If you accept somebody exactly where they are and you treat people without judgment and without expectation that they're going to do something for you immediately, the change in the ability to connect with people with addiction becomes enormous. And this is why things like needle exchange programs and safe injection facilities are so powerful, because not only do they provide direct tools to reduce risk, but when you are an addicted person and everybody hates you and everybody blames you and you are seen as a liar and a manipulator and somebody you can't trust and a criminal, and somebody actually just treats you decently, it's such a shock. And it's such a different way of being interacted with that people open the door for change. I've seen this many times at these kinds of places where people who are just so marginalized and so down and out actually smile, and you've never seen them smile. And during that brief interaction, you can begin to make people feel valued. And if people feel valued, they can begin to value themselves, and if they do that, they can begin to progress towards healthier behavior. You know, it can sort of seem like, you know, you want to shake people with addiction and say, wake up, stop this, like, you're killing yourself, you're harming your family, why are you doing this? The thing is, from the inside, it just looks like the drug is the only thing that's keeping you alive, and the drug is the only thing that's allowing you to cope at all. And so you perceive everything else as just like trying to take away the love of your life. And obviously people will react badly to that.
So what does this mean in terms of an institutional or public health response? You know, there are a number of different attempts to try and make a difference at this moment, you know, restricting opioid access, needle exchanges, safe injection sites. So what do you think the general public is getting right?
So here's what we need to be supporting. We have two treatments that cut the death rate by 50% or more. And those two treatments are long-term use of either methadone or buprenorphine, which the brand name is Suboxone.
Mm-hmm.
We demonize those treatments. We tell people that you're still addicted if you're on those treatments, even though we're misunderstanding that addiction is compulsive use of drugs despite negative consequences, which when you're stabilized on maintenance, you don't have. And we're confusing that with physical dependence, which means needing something to function. Needing something to function isn't necessarily a problem. Compulsive use despite negative consequences is definitely a problem. What these medications do for some people is immediately allow them to stop the compulsive behavior and to stabilize their lives and to simply get on with it. And when you're on a steady dose of these medications, you are not impaired. So the idea that people who are, you know, on these medications can't be reached emotionally or any of these other things is simply not true. You can drive, you can love, you can work, you can do all of these things. We get misconceptions about these medications because there's a second way to use them as well, which is that some people are not going to stabilize. They're going to continue to take other drugs. They will therefore continue to be high at some times. They will therefore continue to be unavailable at some times. But they are still at dramatically reduced risk of dying if they're on the medication. So the most important thing that the public can support is immediate, low threshold, like no barrier access to these medications. You walk into a doctor's office, you get it. And, you know, obviously there need to be some controls, but it the way we do it now is just far too restrictive. The other larger thing to do is locking people up for possessing a substance does not help anybody. Yeah, there's a much bigger argument to be had over whether you legalize sales of various things, but no one has ever been helped by being put in a cage for a couple of days, which is what we do for drug possession. It makes no sense to waste all that money locking up people. You know, you could say, well, oh, like, let's just put them in treatment instead. But A, we don't have treatment even for all the people who want it. And why should we be putting somebody who isn't ready in ahead of somebody who actually wants it and is sitting there on a waiting list? So we need to not criminalize it, because you can't destigmatize something that is criminal. The whole point of criminalizing drugs was to stigmatize them so that people don't do them. If you're already addicted, that's a bit too late for that. And there's actually no evidence that criminal possession penalties deter anybody. That's obviously a long-term thing, but it would make a huge difference, because we spend billions of dollars on, you know, locking people up for a few days and then setting them free and then locking them up again and then setting them free without ever helping them.
So if you are looking at social capital as capital, you know, as this resource that we have, this holding, what is the best way then to spend it?
If we motivate our civic organizations and our voting and our participation in order to guide us towards treating people more compassionately, it will increase social capital for everybody. I mean, one of the real tragedies of the overdose epidemic is that young people are dying who could have given so much. Older people are dying who could have given so much. These are not people that are useless. You know, the thing about addiction where you persist despite negative consequences, that skill is incredibly useful as long as it's not directed towards drugs. Because if you want to be a writer, you certainly have to persist despite rejection. And if you want to be an activist, you have to persist despite things really not going your way for a really long time and all sorts of stuff like that. But so we're just losing resources that we shouldn't be losing. We're losing moms and dads and sisters and brothers and cousins and people who, you know, are really kind, wonderful people. We tend to think that people with addiction are like horrible, selfish, evil people, and that is a stereotype. It's certainly the case that during active addiction, people may lie to protect their addiction. But other than that, people with addiction are no more likely to be dishonest or criminal than anyone else. There is one exception, which is people who have addiction and antisocial personality disorder, but thankfully the vast majority of people with addiction do not have that. And it is wrong and harmful to stereotype everybody who's addicted with that brush.
Maya Solovitz, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Maya Solovitz, she's a journalist covering addiction and drugs, and you can find a link to her work at our website, which is wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, Benjamin Clementine went from homeless busker to award-winning songwriter just a few years ago. He's bringing his powerful voice and strikingly original performance to Portsmouth early next month. We'll get a preview when Word of Mouth continues.
I'm alone in a box of stone. When all is said and done, as the wind blows to the east from the west.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR. The British-born composer and musician Benjamin Clementine has been compared to Jacques Brel, described as Nina Simone singing the Leonard Cohen songbook, and named by the New York Times as one of the 28 geniuses who define culture. His sound is one of a kind. Benjamin Clementine will be performing live on Thursday, February 1st at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, and we're lucky enough to catch up with him. Where are you? London, Benjamin?
I'm in London, yes.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now, you grew up in a very religious family in North London. I read that you weren't allowed to listen to music. So where'd you learn to play?
I just had to, you know, somehow hide playing music, you know? You know, sort of, I did hide and seek with my parents a lot, playing music. My brother brought a piano from a friend, talking about keyboard, piano keyboard. And, you know, he tried to learn how to play it, but then eventually he got bored of it. And so I started playing it. And yeah, but as soon as my parents would come home from work, I'd stop playing it. So it took a long time for me to somehow manage to play a chord or two.
So were you just playing by ear and imitating musicians?
I was, yes. I was imitating classical music. Very Eric Satie sort of classical music. And, you know, I can't read music, so I tried to imitate it by ear.
Well, eventually you left school at 16 and I guess left home at 17, yeah. Moved to Paris. So what was life like in Paris for a teenage boy, you know, living on his own?
It was tough, you know. I wouldn't want any young boy to live in a place where they have no family and no friends and no one who would care about them. I wouldn't want that. It was very tough. But, you know, because I grew up from a Christian background, I learned, you know, quickly and how to respect people and, you know, and be humble and, you know, be kind to people. And that eventually mirrored. So people were nice to me and kind to me because I was that to them. That was my fortune.
But I would also imagine that's sort of a double-edged thing. You must have been somewhat sheltered living in a deeply religious family. Were you not?
Yes, I wasn't. You know, we were told never to listen to pop music and popular music and, you know, not to be obsessed with the world and what is in it because there's nothing good in it. So we were always protected from watching television. I mean, hardly watching television because of the superficiality of what comes out of it. So, yes, in that sense, yes, we were sheltered. But I think that there was a better way to do it than that, I'd say.
What do you mean?
What I mean is, you know, you can tell a child not to touch a fire, but you have to give the child opportunity to choose whether or not to touch the fire, you know? So in terms of television or music, I had to, you know, have the option to choose whether or not to turn on the television and watch something or not. And I didn't get that opportunity, and that's what I'm talking about. So the approach taken isn't one that I would take for my own children, or, you know, that's not what I would tell other people to do. What you want to do is you want the child to feel like they're, you know, making choices for themselves.
So there you are, thrust into the world. We have a clip of you playing in the metro in Paris. The story here, Benjamin, is that that's where you were spotted. Did I get that right? By someone from a record company. I suppose the word discovery is a problematic one.
Yeah, it certainly is a problematic one because no one really gets discovered. I worked so hard for myself and eventually I met so many people who promised so much, so little. Nothing really happened. And eventually, out of somebody, from somebody to somebody, I met another person, not from the train, but, you know, we're human beings. We like beautiful stories. So if people want it to be from the train, then so be it. But, you know, it's from the train that I, you know, knew somebody not in the train. And eventually I recorded a few songs You know, it took a long time for my music to eventually record professionally, and then I went back to England to release the album.
Right, so this is your first record, yeah. We do love that story of instant success, but it took some time. But you did get, you know, a lot of exposure in 2013. There's a BBC program later with Jules Holland. Let's hear just a little bit from that performance.
Tears have their solemn rest. I'm alone, alone in a box of stone. They claim to love me, but they're all lying. I've been alone, alone in a box of my own.
Benjamin, this must have been really life-changing for you at that time. Did you expect it?
No, I didn't. I didn't expect it at all, because I didn't know what it was. You know? So, I suppose I'm just living life on the edge.
So you won this Mercury Prize for your debut album, At Least For Now, which came out in early 2015. Now your newest album, I Tell a Fly, came out in the fall. Is there a song on that record that you'd like us to play that, you know, sort of shows how your music has evolved or where you're at now?
I would rather you play the simplest of them all, and that is Jupiter, because that song really pretty much is, it epitomizes the whole idea of the app.
Lost control, guess where he stopped for petrol. Wishing Americana happy. Wishing Americana free. Benz on alien passing by.
The album is about two flies in love. So what's really behind that story?
The real purpose of this story is it's just a story. It's a story about travelers and wanderers. I mean, we live in a world right now where, you know, we're constantly being, what's it called, fed with the idea that people are running away from their country to come to our country to live and take all that we have that we don't have. And this album in a nutshell is to say that after all, we're all travelers, and one day our children will have to go somewhere else to live comfortably.
Do you, you know, now you're a musician touring all over the world, do you feel like you're still a wanderer?
Well, I am. I'll forever be. I am a wanderer and I'll forever be. It's not what's called an idea or some sort of a philosophy. It really is a fact. Either I'm wondering what I'm going to eat or where I'm going to go, whether to a corner shop or to work, or whether I'm wondering you know, somewhere in Arizona. You know, it's I'll forever be. There's nothing I can do about it.
Benjamin Clementine, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Benjamin Clementine, he's a composer, artist, musician. He's going to be performing at the Portsmouth Music Hall on February the 1st. You find links to more on his music and to his Tiny Desk concert for NPR at wordofmouthradio.org.
If I held my breath on you, I would have died a thousand times. And if chewing was to show you how much I cared, I'll probably wear indentures by now. Said if I held my breath on you, I would have died a thousand times. And if chewing was to show you how much I cared, I'll probably be wearing dentures by now.
Thank you so much for spending some of your precious time with us today. Special thanks to Tim Rourke and Michael Botticelli. Today's show was produced by Jimmy Gutierrez with Taylor Quimby, Hannah McCarthy, Ben Henry, and Justine Paradise. Maureen McMurray is director of Cruising for Dreamhouses on Zillow. Music in this episode from Benjamin Clementine, Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, and Jazar. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.